does a baby get human rights?
Answering that question with specificity is above my pay grade.
Faith without works is dead. People need to carpool more. And because Americans are so overweight, it might not be too bad to walk more.
If I have to follow him to the gates of hell, I will get Osama bin Laden.
Congratulations. All of my gay friends, I'm like, when are you getting married? I want weddings.
Well, all over the country today, people are celebrating the value of labor, a life of labor, ironically by taking the day off, most of us. And we are a country of laborers, of work, of valued hard work. All of us have heard that phrase, the Protestant work ethic. Well, where did it come from? Do Christians view work, labor, their jobs, their callings, their vocations, whatever they may be, differently than unbelievers? And what has been the primary influence of Christianity on our conception of labor and work and our jobs? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. this Labor Day. I'm Todd Wilkin, and thanks for tuning us in. Dr. Alvin Schmidt will be our guest. We're going to talk about the influence of Christianity on labor and economic freedom. A little later in the hour, we'll talk to Dr. John Seleska about Joshua. The church remembers Joshua, Old Testament saint, on this day. Dr. Alvin Schmidt is professor emeritus of sociology at Illinois College. He's author of the book, How Christianity Changed the World. Dr. Schmidt, welcome back.
Thank you for having me again.
What is the primary way on this Labor Day that Christianity has transformed our view of labor?
Well, there are a number of things. First of all, our understanding of labor in our society and culture and for a long time is really often not very compatible with what the Bible and the Old Testament and the New Testament talks about. We tend to see work and labor sort of as an end in itself, and it's totally divorced from anything that God might have in mind pertaining to it. And that's very, very unfortunate, because we know way back already in the Old Testament, in the days of Moses, that labor was highly valued when he told, for example, Moses, the people, that the laborer is worthy of his hire. You can read in an awful lot of non-biblical literature, and you never see any value attached to labor. It's just simply not there. But it begins in the Old Testament, and then you see it, for example, in early Christianity, where Paul underscores the value of labor when he says, if someone doesn't work, he shouldn't eat. In other words, he's writing to the Thessalonians here saying that labor is very important. There was never any acceptance on the part of the Old or New Testament of drones, so to speak, who sit back and do nothing. You have the Benedictine proverb, for example, in the Middle Ages of the monastery era and the like, saying work to work is to pray. They very much saw work in the context of God's desire. Then you have Luther in the Reformation, who gave even more emphasis to work that we really often, even those who call themselves Lutherans, have no clue. Luther spoke about work being the larvae Dei, the Latin term for the mask of God, that God was hidden in a person's work, so hidden that you don't see him. In fact, that's why most of us tend to see work divorced from anything theologically important. Yet Luther argued that that's exactly where God was, in a person's work, particularly in the work of a Christian, because it is in work that God keeps his whole creation going, and therefore he is hidden in it, but we don't see it. And so Luther emphasized that. And Luther also made a contribution that God in work does not attach status to work as we do in our society. Being a sociologist myself, I know how much status we attach to work. We have social class scales developed in terms where work is one of the most prominent weighty factors in assessing a person's class standing, whether he's upper class or lower upper class, upper middle, lower middle, working class, and so on down the line. But Luther also argued, for example, that work in God's eyes was not what or how, but not what you do, but how and why you do it. You do it to the glory of God. It brings to mind what Paul wrote to the Corinthians and said, whatsoever you do, whether you eat or drink, do it all to the glory of God. And that is another aspect of work that we really, even as Christians, so frequently are not aware of.
I want to come back to something you mentioned there about Luther's conception of labor drawn from Scripture's testimony, mm-hmm. his idea of vocation or a calling that yep. extended to every station in life, those we recognize as formal callings and professions and those that we don't, and his emphasis on the service to the neighbor. Talk about that.
Yeah, you know, Luther was great in saying it, and it's another thing we need to be reminded of. In fact, maybe haven't even heard it before. We talk about, and obviously Christians are supposed to do good works. But Luther says, we do good works not for God. He doesn't need them, but your neighbor does. And so often I think when we tend to think so people don't quite get it clear that you're saved by grace alone, but you have to do some good works, the good works are often understood as doing something for God. No. You do them for your neighbor who needs them. And that's exactly, again, what work does too. By working, you do an awful lot for your neighbor. You do a lot for your society. It's not just as we so tritely sometimes say, well, I have a job. I don't really like it, but it puts food on the table. That's not the biblical or nor was it Luther's understanding of work.
All right. We mentioned the Protestant work ethic?
Mm-hmm.
Where did this term come from, and what exactly does it mean?
Yes, it's an interesting, there's a whole book that was written in 1904 by a German sociologist called Max Weber. We would say Weber, but the academic community does use the German pronunciation and say Max Weber. He wrote a book in 1904 called The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. His basic argument was that it was the Protestant ethic, you could say basically, in some ways it was more Calvinistic than it was Lutheran, that put a tremendous, together with work being a vocation and that work was God-pleasing, there was another dimension in Weber's argument that really enhanced the term the spirit of capitalism. You know, in the Middle Ages and even before the Middle Ages, the church leaders had a lot of trouble with taking of interest when you loaned money. It was called usury. Even Luther has long sermons against usury because it was believed that you should not take interest from money. Weber's argument was, and he's right here, that Calvin was the first one really in the Christian church that did not see usury or taking interest from money as wrong and sinful. And that is what lies behind, according to Weber, the spirit of capitalism, behind the Protestant ethic. It was, and you see, when the Middle Ages, when they argued against taking interest of money's usury, they had still what I would call an agrarian understanding of monetary systems. Because in the days even of the Old Testament, and you can cite a number of passages from the Old Testament that oppose the taking of interest from money. Now, we today think nothing of it. We buy a house on loan, we pay interest, we buy cars on loan, we pay interest, and none of us for one moment think we're doing something that's anti-biblical. But in the old days, in the agrarian days, the people who borrowed money or needed to have money were the poor and the destitute, and therefore you were not supposed to charge them interest. But come with the late Middle Ages, and particularly with the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, the people who now primarily were borrowing money was not the poor, but the people who were investing it in factories and other business pursuits so they could provide a product and also provide work. And so the whole thing has changed now. I would argue if Luther were here today, he would not have argued against usury. But in his day, too, most of the lending of money was given to poor people, and they really couldn't afford to pay any more. So you were take back what you gave them, but you weren't supposed to take any interest on it. Well, Calvin changed all that, and that really, in many ways, imbued the Protestant ethic. And without investment in capital, you couldn't have advanced society as we have in the Western world. And what's interesting is where has, for example, the growth of industries and economics, and I know that today the liberal media often slurs capitalism as an evil, but capitalism is easy, actually a equal to economic freedom. And the negative aspects of capitalism really can be traced back to communist leader Karl Marx and his co-worker of Lenin. But capitalism is not an evil system as we hear today, because it basically gives economic freedom and permits, enables economy to grow.
Let's take a break right there, Dr. Schmidt, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation on the influence of Christianity on labor and economic freedom. This Labor Day, we think about all those who have worked, who do work, who, you know, we talk about the engine that makes the economy tick or the fuel fueling the economy. It's more than about money or about markets. It's about people in their daily vocations serving their neighbors and thereby serving God. And it all works pretty nicely when we come back. Is God a capitalist? We'll be right back. If you're a talk radio junkie like me, you might assume that the programming is free. Commercial advertisers pay for the production costs and staff salaries. Well, that's true for most talk radio shows, but not for Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is listener supported. We rely upon you to pay for the production, salaries, and airtime costs for this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin, asking you to consider making a financial gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org, or donate by check, Lutheran Public Radio, Box 1046, SJC, California, 92693. That's Box 1046, SJC, California, 92693. Remember, unlike other talk radio shows, Issues Etc. needs your financial support. We depend upon you for the continuation and expansion of Issues Etc. Thanks for your consideration.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Here's an easy way for you to publicize Issues Etc. at your church. Go to the promote page of our website, issuesetc.org, and you'll find a short paragraph to include in your weekly church bulletin. Help inform your fellow parishioners about Issues Etc. issuesetc.org, click promote, and copy and paste the text for your church secretary or pastor to include each week in the Sunday bulletin. We update this paragraph weekly. issuesetc.org.
What is it, Captain?
Whatever it is, it's incredibly advanced.
Hey iPhone users, you can now listen to Issues Etc. live on your iPhone. Find out by going to piratechristianradio.com and click the iPhone link on the homepage. You no longer have to sit by your PC, laptop, or home radio to listen to Issues Etc. live. piratechristianradio.com and look for the iPhone icon.
With something much, much more. And it's going to change everything.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Monday, Labor Day, we're talking with Dr. Alvin Schmidt about labor and economic freedom and why we have it as a result largely of the influence of Christianity in society. Dr. Schmidt, before the break, you were talking about capitalism. You made the point that in and of itself, capitalism is not a sinful system, as some might assert or assume. But is God a capitalist?
Well, I don't know if you want to. Well, certainly God has nothing against capitalism, because capitalism basically is a synonym for economic freedom. And as, for example, has been said by even in my book where I have a chapter on economic freedom, like I quote a Jewish rabbi by the name of Daniel Lapin, who said, quote, "It's no accident that a capital market has never arisen indigenously in any non-Christian country, end of quote. He is so right. Not long ago, only a few months ago, Milton Friedman, a famous economist at the University of Chicago, I think he was about 90 years old when he died, also not a Christian, but basically of Jewish background, Milton Friedman wrote an excellent book back in the late 50s, early 1960s, when I used to teach a course in economics at Concordia University in Seward, Nebraska. I had this as a supplementary text. It's called Capitalism and Freedom. And he made a statement, quote, "A society which is socialist cannot also be democratic in the sense of guaranteeing individual freedom," end quote. So, yes, you can say, for example, that God, if you want to put it bluntly, is a capitalist in that he does not condemn capitalism. You see, we have another major confusion, and it permeates our whole political thinking today. And that is, for example, when we talk about that you have to support governmental welfare programs if you're a Christian, because if not, somehow or another, you are a bad capitalist and whatnot. But what's missing in the point, you know, I often used to tell my students that Christian socialism is an oxymoron. Socialism, some of the early Christians, if you read in the book of Acts, practiced socialism, if you will, but it was totally voluntary. We also had many people in the New Testament, for example, that continued to own their own houses. They didn't give it away. Cornelius, for example, and you know the mother of Mark, for example, they had their own house. It was not wrong to have it. Or, for example, when you have the situation where Ananias and Sapphira said they gave everything they have to God but lied about it, and then after it was discovered, they were told what you had was yours. In other words, God gave it to you, and the whole commandment of thou shalt not steal underlies the value of private property, and without private property, you can't have capitalism. So when people talk about Christian socialism, as I said, these are contradictory terms. Because it's coercive. Once the government forces you or me to give something to welfare, it's no longer Christian. It might be humanitarian, but it's not Christian, because the voluntary aspect of it is gone. And it's only Christian as long as I do it voluntary. This is something that we simply don't understand and have never really been taught. And so capitalism is not an evil. Because, as I said, it enables economic freedom. And when you look, for example, at all the different cultures, where do you have the greatest disparity between the poor and the rich? It's not in capitalistic countries. It is in socialistic countries. And this is another point that never is being made, partly because our media today is so leftist-oriented, and they don't know any history, they don't know any biblical knowledge. But so you can say God definitely is not opposed to capitalism, and I have no problem saying God is a capitalist. Question is a good one, and I think the answer that I just gave is perfectly in conformity with the Bible.
Okay, so in the sense of private property and of economic freedom and all of those things that are attached to capitalism, I think I'd probably agree with you there. I don't want to be misunderstood as though we're saying God is, in some sense, kind of behind everything that's done in the name of capitalism.
Oh, of course not. You know, any system that we have in the world can be abused, and capitalism is no exception. We talk about the abuses of socialism. I mean, in many ways, they're worse than they are of capitalism. And given that we're celebrating Labor Day, as I also mentioned in the book, had Christians been properly oriented to the workers, those who owned factories and the like, and paid them a decent salary and what have you, maybe we would never have had powerful, coercive labor unions come on the way, again, because there was an abuse. Now you have abuses also with labor unions. Well, whatever system you have, it sooner or later will be abused by people because it is operated by sinful human beings. So, yes, I'm not saying that capitalism is without any warts, so to speak. But it's not really the problem of capitalism. It's the people who misuse it.
Okay, let's talk about another term that is so commonly thrown around when we talk about our economy or about our labor and economic freedom, and that is the middle class. Mm-hmm. Give us just a very brief history lesson, if you would, on the emergence of the middle class largely under the influence of Christianity. What was it like before there was some such a thing as the middle class?
Well, you see, I just said to my wife a couple of days ago, when you listen to the politicians, having taught sociology for 36 years at four different institutions and the like, and sociologists make a lot of noise about social classes. And I said to my wife, apparently people have never, ever learned the most basic element about social class. And the politicians talk about middle class. They know not whereof they speak. The middle class is apparently, they talk about what it really assumes is there are only three classes, upper, middle, and lower. And this is simply not true. We have for over 60 years scientific, well-conducted studies that we have in the American society and in most industrial societies five social classes. There is the upper class, then there is the upper middle class, the lower middle class, the upper working class, and the lower class. And so what is often talked, and the politicians confuse the working class, which is the blue-collar workers. These are your factory people, comprise about 40% of the population. These are the people who wear blue collars to work, the people who are mechanics, the people who work on factory assembly lines, the people who install your air condition, fix your air condition, the people who, on construction. These are the working-class, blue-collar people. When you get to, for example, the lower middle class, now you're talking about the clerical class. These are the people who work in offices, secretaries, and the like. And then you talk about the upper middle class. The upper middle class, and all of this is very well corroborated by the research, upper middle class are the largely professional people, the people who have college degrees, usually graduate degrees, who are doctors and lawyers and professors and clergymen who are seminary graduates and the like. These are the upper middle class. And then you have the upper class, which about 2-3% that are the people who have wealth inherited for generations, the Rockefellers, the Vanderbilts, the Kennedys and the like. These are the upper class. So when we hear about middle class, the politicians confuse middle class with the working class or the blue-collar class. And it's to me, appalling that we really give and we use class now in political terms, largely, again, an influence from Karl Marx, who brought about class warfare envy. And if you listen to our politicians today, what do you hear? It's always a class war envy and the like. So middle class is really a very bad term. It simply doesn't describe. It makes perhaps people who are in the working class feel they are. And, research shows that working class people do not see themselves in the middle class because there really is none. As I said, there are two. There's the upper middle class and the lower middle class. And then you move to the blue-collar or the working class. And so I don't know if I answered your question.
Well, I guess I'm just wondering, and this will have to be our final question with only a minute. Before we had anything in between, there was those who had and those who had not, and those who had not were at the mercy of those who had. And is it because of Christianity's influence that there are people who flourish in between the two? Only 1 minute, Dr. Schmidt.
Yes, you do. Very much. If you want to just forget what I talked about and talk about a middle class, assuming there are only three, very much is a product of Christianity's influence. Because if you go, for example, in society where Christianity has had little or no presence, you really do not have that sort of middle class. It was tied with economic freedom. You really don't have much of a middle class at all, if you want to talk about that, in the Greek and the Roman societies. It was largely a society of two classes. The people who hired people to work, and work, by the way, was an evil among the philosopher kings, the educated people, and the like, going back to before the birth of Christ. And then Christianity came along and made work noble and prosperous. And that had a great deal to do with bringing about a middle class, if we want to use that term.
Dr. Alvin Schmidt is professor emeritus of sociology at Illinois College. He's author of the book, How Christianity Changed the World. You can read a chapter of this book on the on-demand page of our website, issuesetc.org. Issuesetc.org. Dr. Schmidt, thanks for being our guest.
Well, thank you.
Scripture says that God is no respecter of persons.
What does that mean? Well, the distinctions that we make, and we Americans are guilty of this more than perhaps others, we make distinctions in how much you make. What kind of job do you do? Are you a professional? Are you a laborer? God is no respecter of persons. There is one medium by which God looks upon you or me. There's that famous passage, there is neither Jew, Greek, male, female. We could probably extend list, rich, poor, professional, non-professional, college graduate, high school graduate, high school dropout. God is no respecter of persons. He loves us and values us because of the work of His Son, Jesus Christ, on our behalf. And the work that we do in this world gains us nothing with God. Only what Christ has done for us. Our work is for our neighbor. It gains everything for our neighbor. When we come back, we're going to talk about Joshua with Dr. Tim Seleska.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Will your church be one of the Issues Etc. 300? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. We're looking for 300 congregations to pledge $1,000 to Issues Etc. in their budgets. To find out more about the Issues Etc. 300, click the Sponsors section of our website, issuesetc.org. You'll even find a one-page informational flyer. Please consider including Issues Etc. in your church's mission or advertising budget. The Issues Etc. 300.
A flood of biblical proportions in New Orleans?
Answers with Ken Ham, president of the Apologetics Ministry of Answers in Genesis.
You may recall that 3 years ago, Hurricane Katrina caused massive amounts of floodings in New Orleans, as well as other parts of the Gulf Coast of America. Well, I certainly wouldn't compare that flooding to Noah's flood, but others did. During round-the-clock TV coverage of the devastation along the Gulf, I heard different people, on more than one occasion, say that the flooding in New Orleans was of biblical proportions. Well, what happened in New Orleans was just a local, but still disastrous flood, where the water poured into the city and slowly filled up the bowl the city sits in. The flood recorded in Genesis was a global catastrophe that destroyed everything on the earth. The flood in New Orleans was not even close to being of biblical proportions. But looking at the terrible damage from a hurricane and its flooding gives a little inkling of how devastating the global flood of Genesis really was. You know, sadly, generations of people now have little or no concept of what the Bible teaches concerning the flood of Noah's day.
As we approach the end of the week, this is one of your final opportunities to receive a copy of our fascinating audio CD on the Islamic faith. In it, Ken Ham interviews a former Muslim extremist. In fact, he helped overthrow the Shah of Iran 30 years ago. Well, just present us with a gift of any size and we'll send the CD to you. Call us toll-free at 1-888-89-ANSWERS, 888-89-ANSWERS, or on the web, answersoffer.org.